bill that we just passed in both bodies in front of us with one change, which is there are two places in this bill where there would be a blank for a rate decrease.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the 1988A-1 amendment.
Members, there have been some technical corrections made to this that the staff have incorporated as they discovered them. Is there any member who would like to have those technical corrections explained? Okay. Then is there any discussion?
They're just technical, right, Madam Chair?
Yes.
We have good staff, actually.
They're the kind of things that would have been in a revisor's bill if we weren't having this meeting.
We might still need a revisor's bill if this gets signed, Madam Chair.
We might need one, but...
Keep them handy.
We are keeping all our options open here. Sure. Any further discussion?
What's the motion, Madam Chair?
To adopt this.
And, Madam Chair, under Senate rules, that means something else than it does under House rules, I think. What do you mean to adopt this? We're going to send this back to the floor?
No, we're just adding it to the bill that we sent to conference committee.
Right, so it's just putting it in the...
Yes.
Okay.
It is to put the bill that we passed in front of us. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. Then we have another technical amendment, which is an A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move the A4 amendment.
Mr. Beal, do you want to just briefly explain the amendment?
Sure.
Shannon, can you get the copies?
Madam Chair, members, the lines 3 and 4 of the amendment delete a sentence that had the funding for that cancer surveillance project coming from the department's base appropriation, and that was no longer needed because they got a direct appropriation. So that's coming out. Line 5 deletes an unnecessary rider. And lines 6 and 7 delete language that was left in by accident, that instead of having a couple of transfers from EMS, it made it look like we were actually just offering money directly to Veterans Affairs and Public Safety. We're taking that out, so those are the transfers.
Any discussion?
What was, Madam Chair, what was that last one?
It was just technical corrections to the EMS appropriation to the special projects.
So, Madam Chair, the money is still there?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I was a little late, but I just want to say it's good to be back again. It's that the day off, it was like I was never here.
Yeah,
14 consecutive days, and it's nice. We broke our streak by not meeting yesterday, so we'll have to regain our streak again to beat 14.
Yeah, we had to take a little time out to pass the bills.
Yeah, pesky.
I know the feeling. Any other discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, members, we have a new spreadsheet, and it has two changes in it. It has, at the top, you can see we have a $401,318,000 reduction, and it is accounted for on page 15, line 536, where you will see a 25% rate reduction to long-term care facilities. This would include nursing facilities, ICFMR, DTNH, and there are others. Then if you turn and look on page 31, you will see a 20.5% inpatient hospital ratable reduction. Those two numbers get us to our $400+ million number at the top of the sheet. And that is the number that is that has been passed by the House and the Senate in the tax bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
But that spreadsheet doesn't reflect the bill we just adopted. That's just
these are changes to the bill we just adopted.
These were in the bill we just adopted.
No, these are changes.
Oh, that would be proposed by the Senate?
Well, they are what we need to do if we don't get some additional revenue to balance the budget.
Oh, I understand, but that's not an amendment we just adopted. Those aren't in this.
No.
Oh, thank you.
We
just
have
to be sure.
An A3 amendment that we can hand out now that we will place on the table, and then we will take some testimony about it.
Madam Chair, are we going to discuss it after it's passed out, or are we just going to take the testimony?
I think we should take the testimony, and then we can have some discussion.
Okay. Madam Chair, let me just offer a comment, though, if I may break your order.
Representative Abler.
I think this is – I appreciate the just discovering this here. And this certainly is the harshest way you could cut $400 million, which no one's proposing. And I think that as we hear the testimony about if this were proposed, the harm that would happen, it's based upon an unimaginable idea that nobody would vote for at this table, or I think in either body, or in executive office. And so I think if we do have a $400 million target, we can accomplish that through some thoughtful 14 consecutive days of work and hurt the least number of people and even do some good reform that might actually produce less cuts in the future. So I hope that after this is over, we can be about the business of that.
Representative Abler, the two largest spending areas we have in our budget are the two areas that we just looked at on the spreadsheet. And so, you know, maybe you could nickel and dime a few of the numbers off of here, but basically at $400 million, you're talking in the neighborhood of. Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, just a comment. Probably 90% of the Health and Human Services budget is either hospitals, nursing homes and related facilities, or help for people that have disabilities. And so if you're going to make $400 million in additional cuts, you're going to have to cut those things. There's no other way that we can balance this budget unless we do severe cuts to those three things.
And I might add that we are balancing our tails, which the governor didn't. But he did say that he would make another 32% reduction in Health and Human Services to balance the tails without telling us exactly how it would happen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'm not saying I like this seat I'm in right now or I like the position that we're in. But I do suggest that if we did another $400 million number, which is not our target, by the way, and it's just a hypothetical target, based upon many things happening in arenas beyond us, that we would do many things like what you've been doing, what I've been trying to work on, where if I save $5 and $10 million here, you change some of the way we go about our business. You decide certain people need a better kind of service. Your birth center idea would be revisited. And some of those ideas, going after some inefficient care that's delivered across the system, which drives even poorer outcomes. And I think that the table would be open, and maybe they'd actually encourage us to work on some of those things. Maybe the Gottwald provision would make some sense. And so, Madam Chair, before I ever vote for this amendment, I'll tell you, I'm going to sit here for a month every day and miss work to make that not happen. And we'll do it together, you and I and whoever else wants to come thoughtfully. And so that's my commitment to this process. And so just so you know, and the people who testify, I'm not on board for that, for this deal that they'll talk about today.
We have been able to get a run for the nursing facilities. We have a run that we hope will be here before we finish today for the hospitals. Any other discussion? Representative Huntley.
Again, Madam Chair, this is where the money is. It's in nursing homes, hospitals, and people with disabilities. And we can, I suppose we could nitpick and say we've already taken, for instance, eligibility at PCA from what used to be you had to have one ADL. What's ADL again? Activity of daily living. We're in the tails. We're moving that up. You have to have two to get any help. I suppose we could move that to four and save some all the money in PCAs if that's what we wanted to do. But this is what we are faced with, an additional $400 million in cuts on top of the $500 million we already did. There is no way we can't hit nursing homes and hospitals.
And Representative Abler, certainly we're going to keep working to try to shave these numbers down, but until we find a way to do that, then these are the numbers that we would be looking at.
Madam Chair, I'm not storming out. I'm just going to vote. I'll come back.
So good.
If that's good news or bad news, I don't know which. But
good. And I hope the House doesn't mind if we start the testimony.
On behalf of the House.
Are there any other questions? Not, then we have people that have been waiting, so we'll start hearing from them. First one I have on my agenda is Mark Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Peterson. I'm the president of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. It's not always a great pleasure to be first in line because I'm not exactly sure what all the range of my comments can be. If it's limited to the question for us, as associated with line 536, my comments will be limited to our experience with ICFSMR. Mm-hmm. Is that appropriate?
That would be appropriate.
I will speak to that and put a frame around that. LSS of Minnesota provides services for persons from every county in the state. And our service with persons with disabilities is a very significant part of our portfolio of care. We operate ICFSMR in Carlstadt, in Shoreview, and in Red Wing, totaling probably 46 clients. Simply put, a 25% rate cut closes all of those facilities. Toot sweet. It's as simple as that. There isn't. Those all run on terribly thin margins to begin with, so a significant rate cut shuts them down. It's pretty simple. And then the disposition with the what happens with those clients, I don't have the foggiest idea. I mean, they return to the counties, and the counties need to sort through. Typically, those clients are persons with fairly significant need, especially the facility in Red Wing, and their care will need to be assumed in some fashion, the likes of which I can't begin to tell you. But that would do that. They're probably, for us, about between 45 and 50 clients affected by that.
Mr. Peterson, in the event that the facilities would close, of course, there'd be 100% savings. So can you tell us where you think the tipping point is, where maybe some facilities would close but others would be able to continue to stay open?
Well, the planning that we've been engaged in for the last several weeks has been assuming a 3% rate cut to on a going forward basis. And for us, the concern is the combination of rate cut plus limits on plus the caps. And those two together, from our perspective, need to be looked at in tandem. Because caps, when one person leaves a four-bed facility, All of a sudden, you only have 75% of the revenue, and there's no way to reduce the revenue for a four-bed group home by 25%. So the caps and the rate cuts need to be taken together. In our planning, we've been assuming a 3% rate cut, and we believe we will not need to close any of our residences for that reason. We're assuming further reductions in wages, further reductions in benefits, further reductions in transportation for our clients. Those are the strategies we've been putting in place. We have, since 2003, leaned out our middle management fairly dramatically. We don't believe that there is much room at all for any further reductions of our middle management staff, who are kind of the principal guardians of quality in our residences. And we think that we're running on that thin edge now. So our planning has been for a 3% rate cut. And with that, we're assuming no closures, but with fairly significant reductions in wages and benefits, since that's 75% of our cost.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Margaret Perryman.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Perryman. I'm the CEO at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare in St. Paul, Minnesota. Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare was started by the state in 1897, and our purpose is to provide healthcare services to children in Minnesota for children who are disabled. We provide care to children in every county in Minnesota. In fact, more than 50% of the patients for whom we provide care live outside the metropolitan area. In addition, 50% of our patients are on medical assistance. So as we see the proposed Medicaid cuts, we are very concerned about the impact on our ability to provide health care services for children with disabilities. We appreciate that the current proposal is 1%, especially since over the last 7 years there have been a series of cuts in Medicaid, as you well know. 7 years ago, Gillette Children's broke even on our Medicaid business. Now we are receiving about 60 cents on every dollar of costs. These cuts, the 25% additional cut, will put us in a position where we will be losing about $15 million a year off of costs on the patients who are here for whom we receive care who are on Medicaid. We've accommodated the shortfalls over the last 7 years with a lot of you might define them as creative, or at least tried really hard to continue to provide services to children by changing how we provide the care in small little ways. First of all, we've been able to shift some costs to commercial payers. That's not a big secret. Everybody does know that. However, the payers are also now up against the wall because how they accommodate those shifts is increase the rates to increase the cost of insurance rates to all of us. And employers across the state have expressed great concern out of the cost of health insurance rates, and part of it is because of the shift in costs that's gone from the lack of Medicaid payment. We also have cut a lot of costs inside the organization, moved our resources around. We've increased the number of patients our physicians see in our clinics by shaving off minutes from that they spend with each patient. In fact, this morning I was looking at a report where the demand for physician time in our organization is 30% greater than the supply But we still see all the patients. That just means that everybody gets fewer time. Doctors and nurses are more hassled and harried. It is a great concern to me to see a physician who might have to see 40 patients in a half-a-day clinic. I don't think it's good for the physician, and it's definitely not good for the patients, but that's where we are right now. Other consequences of these cuts are we continue to periodically we do need to borrow money to add space in order to accommodate growth. And those it becomes more and more difficult for us to borrow that money. And interest rates, when we are able to borrow the money, the interest rates are much higher because the lenders recognize that we are covered by the Medicaid program, where 50% of our patients are on Medicaid, and therefore our rates continue to go down. They increase the interest rates because of that risk, and it just overall increases the cost to all of us. However, my job is to keep the organization in the black. That's one of the things that I think is really critical for me to be doing. And so we want to continue to maintain core services for our patients. Our patients depend on us. We take care of about 20,000 children in Minnesota. They depend on us. Their families depend on us. But we have to figure out ways to cut, and we will be having to look at, while maintaining core services, cut resources, cut some of the services that we provide. One of the examples is that we do provide care to children throughout the state of Minnesota through our outreach program. We visit about 15 different communities. Last year, we saved about 400,000 miles of travel for families. That means families didn't have to take their children out of school. They didn't have to take time off work. And in fact, if you figure out what 400,000 miles is, it's 7,000 hours of driving time in a car with children. Most of us wouldn't want to have to do that. But that's one of the programs we're going to have to seriously look at. It's a very expensive program for us to send our staff out throughout the state, and that is one that's a serious concern for us. We also have a nurse triage program where physicians and families from around the state can call our nurses and have assistance and help with a care of patients. You know, most of our patients get their primary care from a local primary care doctor, a family practice, or a pediatrician, and then get specialty care from us. We really are in partnership with these primary care providers, and they depend on us to help them figure out the complexities of children for whom we're both providing care. That's another area we're going to have to look at because it's an expensive service that has no reimbursement. To summarize, I think it's very apparent to say that healthcare is important to all of us, and the cuts that we're looking at will impact all of us one way or another. Children on Medicaid don't come in one door, and children who are not on Medicaid come in a different door. All children come in the same door. If we have to make cuts for Medicaid, we have to make cuts for all. One of the reasons I really like my job, I tell people all the time, is that every day I come to work and I see miracles. And I don't mean the services that we provide to children and the things that we do to help them, but I mean average moms and dads who have taken on the challenges and the responsibility of providing health care service or of taking care of very precious children with disabilities. We form a partnership with those families to help children with disabilities grow up and take their place in the world. And we also form a partnership with the state in helping to fund those services. It is very concerning to me that as we see these cuts, that will we be able to continue to be the partners with families that we've been all of these years? In the end, this is very critical and very important to us. We have very precious few years to help children, and children can't wait for us. Thank you.
Ms. Perryman, perhaps you could tell us in the recent years where you have had losses, how you cover those losses?
Well, we've covered those losses in a lot of creative ways. As I mentioned, we have decreased the amount of time that physicians and nurses spend with our patients. We shave off time with with them. So now we are looking at physicians or a physician clinic who might have 40 patients in that clinic. We've also, for instance, in the past, we used to send 3 people out on our outreach visits, and now we're sending 2 and sometimes only 1, but mostly 2. But we've shaved off expenses in many different places, as well as shifting our costs to the insurance programs.
So, Ms. Perryman, is it possible for you to shave 25% more off?
Senator Berglund, I do not know where I, as I sit here today, where we are going to shave 25% off. However, I do know that families of children with disabilities will continue to need to depend on us, and we have got to figure out a way to solve that problem. But it will be incredibly difficult.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Patty Cullen, John Hun, and Carrie Thurlow.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota. And maybe I'll have my counterparts also introduce themselves since this is a joint presentation.
Patty Cullen with Care Providers of Minnesota, part of the long-term care imperative.
Good afternoon, John Hewen, Chief Operations Officer, Walker Methodist.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what we'll do for our share of the testimony is allow John to go first from a facility-specific perspective, and then Ms. Thurlow and I would talk about the two primary issues that we see with this amendment, which is the financial viability of nursing facilities as well as access for elders and communities.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair, members, for taking time to hear my story. I'm the Chief Operations Officer, Walker Methodist. We represent 920 employees in Minnesota, as well as over 1,000 seniors in the state of Minnesota. We serve seniors in a multitude of accommodations, including HUD facilities, that is subsidized living for seniors, skilled nursing facility. We have independent living with services facilities, assisted living facilities as well. So we cover a very broad spectrum. We are one of those facilities that took advantage of some of the law changes in which we could get a closure rate adjustment. And years ago, we actually transformed a skilled nursing facility in South Minneapolis into a HUD 202 subsidized living facility years ago as part of what we believe to be the right thing towards transformation. Another aspect that's got some sure tails to what we do is we're a partner with the University of Minnesota, and we are a teaching site for them, and we have physicians, nurse practitioners, and we have a dental clinic on campus that serves critical access patients in the community. What we're facing today is obviously monumental to our business, but it's just another example of what we've been challenged with over the years. We continue to be challenged with the same challenges you are. Our rates continue to get reduced, and through that we've been taking what we believe is a very proactive approach in looking at how we can do business very different. We've done the obvious things of reducing expenses in areas where you can, you know, challenging our vendors to give us better pricing. We've done things, we've reduced our management wages between 5% and 15% over the last period of time. We do no longer match our 403B, 401K program. We've done of all those things with the emphasis of not or minimizing the impact to the residents that live in our facility. So it's management staff, supervisors, it's vendors, and all those things that we've tried to do the past multiple years to be able to accommodate the reductions in rates that we've experienced in the past. So we'd like to think we, and I would say for my peers that are out there throughout the state of Minnesota, we've been as proactive as we can in doing the right things for the residents of Minnesota. The impact of 25% rate reduction for Walker Methodist, and I was handed this spreadsheet a few minutes ago. Walker Methodist Health Center is the second one in the list, and our state share of the impact of this rate reduction would be $3.3 million. I'm assuming that's the state share. And so if you take the match, the federal match, that would be nearly $7 million of a rate reduction to our facility and our skilled nursing facility. So you can, that is extremely significant to us. What does that mean to us? We sat down and we looked at this from the perspective of what does it mean to the people that mean the most to us, and that is our residents and our employees. If we were to take just idea, for every million we take of a reduction, it equals 30 jobs. And those are jobs that are at the front line of providing care to the residents. Those aren't COOs. Those are nursing assistants, resident assistants, LPNs, RNs, therapeutic rec coordinators. It's the people that are in direct contact with those residents every single day that really provide a good quality of life to them. So the impact is significant. And that's where we sit at Walker Methodist right now. If further reductions occur, it will be employees. We are at the point where that is what we are left with, is employees. So it challenges us as an organization, and I can sit here and tell you that it challenges us in a couple ways. Number one, our ability to transform into the right thing. We know the baby boomers, myself included, are looking for something different. I attend all the DHS 2010 transformation meetings. I understand what we want as we move forward. Reductions like this not only put our facility in jeopardy of being able to operate, it certainly paralyzes our ability to transform into the right product to serve today into the future. Be that whatever that product may be. The reality is, 25% cut, we as an organization would not be able to continue to operate in the way that we feel is necessary to fulfill our mission, the standards that we have as a facility to meet the regulatory requirements and to meet the needs today and into the future of the seniors. So this is a significant impact on our facility.
And just one clarification, the numbers that are in the sheet that have been handed out are state and federal dollars.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, Patty Cullen with Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm just going to remind you of some facts that we've already released to you in various iterations over the course of the last 10 days. There are 383 nursing facilities participating in Medicaid today. That's 53 fewer than we had in 2000. The primary reason for those facilities closing in the last 9 years has been financial. We've given you information about the latest financial study we've done. We know that nursing facilities throughout the state have negative operating margins, and we've given you this beautifully colored map that show which areas of the state are at the threshold of being on the what we would call the brink of closure. We've given you information about the economic impact, particularly in rural communities where the nursing facility may be the largest employer, providing the most number of jobs in that community, and that each loss in state and federal dollar, what that means and how that converts to lost economic viability for those communities. That data is given to you based on today's perspective, today's amount of money provided to nursing facilities. The $23 a day gap in MA rates between rates and costs is assuming today's threshold of payment, not a 25% reduction. We saw these numbers today, and I would venture to guess, if the question's asked, which I know it will be by the chair, what will happen with a 25% rate reduction? One of two things for the vast majority of my membership. One, they will get out of the Medicaid program. There are 7 nursing facilities today that are not participating in Medicaid, and they're not participating in Medicaid for financial and other reasons. The flexibility to not participate in Medicaid has allowed them to stay open and to do some creative things. To the extent that we know not every facility can do that because of the market share, I would venture to guess you would see a dramatic number of facilities closing. And the implications on closures, I think Carrie's going to talk about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, throughout the session, we've highlighted a couple of different themes with regard to older adult services. One is the financial stability issue that Ms. Cullen has addressed, and the jobs issue that Mr. Hune has addressed. The other issue is access to older adult services across the continuum. And I don't need to remind you that in the previous rendition of this bill, that there were tough decisions that had to be made in terms of cuts already to home and community-based services. And I know that's not the issue today that we're looking at, but in terms of this proposed 25% cut on nursing facilities, it does impact the overall access to the overall continuum of care. And we are starting to ask the question, when seniors need services, where are they going to go? If nursing facilities will close under this particular scenario, and we are already asking for cutbacks on home and community-based services, I really am asking one simple question. Where are our seniors going to go? I know many of you know me on a professional level, and that I do my job on a professional level. I'm just going to share one little piece of personal information with you. I'm the daughter of baby boomers, and I'm the mom of preschoolers. And my preschooler, my four-year-old, is often fond with asking the question, what's the plan, mommy? And I think that that's the exact question here on access that we have to ask is, what is the plan for our seniors? Whether it's providing state-of-the-art care in our care centers in metro and rural communities, or whether it's to provide access to a continuum of services in a place that seniors want when they need their services throughout the state of Minnesota. The question is, what's the plan? And right now, I think the 25% reduction that's on the table is unfortunate because it shows really that we don't have a plan as our boomers begin to get older. And so that's really the question I leave you with today.
Can either of you ladies tell me how many of your facilities are at the minimum staffing ratio?
Certainly, Madam Chair, committee members, we don't have a minimum staffing number. We have a federal regulations, 579 of them, and about 30 of them tie into adequate staffing level. We are seeing an increasing number of facilities getting citations when they are surveyed under that particular tag number. So I would venture to guess that if you look at the trends from the last freeze when they were unable to hire additional staff and had to lay off with the freeze from the 2003, that they haven't added many positions since then. And we continue to see the trend where they get that citation when they have the survey. So that's how we gauge whether or not they're at the lowest threshold level is the number of citations in those areas. And we're seeing an increasing number of facilities. I can't give you a number, but I know that that's occurring right now.
And, Madam Chair, I don't have any additional data to amplify that, but I would concur that within our membership that's likely the similar trend.
Well, perhaps as we continue discussing this, you would be able to get that information for us. And then the second question that I would have is, what are the average wages in your facilities? And if you were to make a reduction in the wages to get to the number, what would the new average wage be?
Madam Chair, committee members, I have the data right here. The average hourly CNA wage in a care center is about $11.70 an hour. That's comparable to over $15 for hospitals, but $11.70. And of course, that varies by region. I know I look at some of the legislators representing rural regions, it's significantly less there. For LPNs, it's about $17 an hour. And for RNs, it's about $25 an hour. And on average for our budgets, about 65 to 70% of the total revenues for nursing facilities is tied to wages and benefits. So you could do the math there in terms of the reductions and what that would mean.
I mean, would it be the same for other facilities across the state, would you say?
Those represent the numbers that I would for my facility as well, so I would say that's pretty representative. We looked at what would the impact be, and this was before the 25% number came across, but we were just looking at if we had to reduce our revenue in our facility by $1.2 million, we would have, in looking out into 2011, we looked at we would have to cut our wages by 1.5% today to make those numbers work in a year and a half. So those are kind of the proactive things that we're looking at, is what we'd have to do today to make something work. That was before I walked into the door, so the math on it would be significantly more.
So we'd be talking about possibly an average wage of $8.70, about $3 reduction.
That's correct.
Are there any other questions? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, this is really a comment, but we got this last week, and I'm from the northeast part of the state, and already 46% of the nursing homes are in negative margins of minus 5% or more. And if you go to the northwest corner of the state, 53% are already have margins of minus 5% or worse. And you can imagine how many of those are going to close.
Yeah.
I know for a fact the one in Two Harbors just up the road from me is closing. There's two or three on the range that are already working through the math to figure out how they can shut down. And if we make these cuts, this is before the cuts.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Not after. This is before the cuts. And if they lose another 20%, you will have 100% of the nursing homes in the northern part of the state losing 5% or more.
And Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, if I may comment as well, that's exactly the access problem that we're concerned about. Those nursing facilities, and in particular those parts of the state, there aren't in excess of nursing facility beds in those areas of the state. And so really that's going to have a wide-reaching impact on jobs, on families, of where seniors are going to get their care, and on the communities themselves. And so it's going to have wide-ranging impacts on access up there.
Other questions? Representative Abler?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe you're helping to make the case why this conference committee, when we get to work, should consider repealing equalization so we can get some private money into the system and help improve the quality of our nursing homes statewide. I don't think the state's in a position for the next 4 years to properly fund. I think the amendment we're talking about is not genuine, and I appreciate your effort at creating a dialogue, but I think to the real issues that we know are there, that would be an opportunity. And I favor encumbering a good part of that for wages so we can maybe get benefits to these good workers and keep them at $11, $13, $15 an hour so they can make a career of it. So thank you.
Representative Abler, I would say this. If we don't go home with a balanced budget, the question is whether we do this all this year or whether we do some of it this year and some of it next year and some of it the year after that. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I walked in on the testimony, so I may be asking a question about something you've already testified to. First of all, can you, any of the witnesses, let me know if you have a sense of the trajectory of admissions over the next 10 years?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we did a demand model study last year and showed that until 2015, we would need an increasing number of nursing facility beds to address the wave of baby boomers that are going to need access to older adult services. And that only is with additional home and community-based services that are able to serve individuals under waiver programs. So those two trajectories till 2015 mean we need an increasing supply. We're not saying we're going to build more beds. We're saying that that's what the demographics show. So that without an increase substantially more of home and community-based services, we go back to the access issue. After 2015, there's a little bit of a downturn for a few years. But I would say that that's the trajectory that we have projected based on the data that we have.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am wondering if you or your colleagues have proposed any policy reform in the last biennium or two. Have you proposed reform of long-term care systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, maybe I can start the answer to that question, and then Ms. Cullen can continue. The short answer to your question is yes. I believe that we've come forward with several policy initiatives that would address across the continuum One of our biggest issues is you can't just look at nursing homes in silos, that you need to look at, as Ms. Collins in her previous answer stated, you have to look across the continuum because they are so interrelated. If we don't make proper investments in home and community-based services and proper reforms on that side, that has an impact on the nursing home budget and vice versa. Some of the things that we have come forward with in terms of reforms in the past few years, I'll be frank with you, many of those reform initiatives have an upfront investment. But some of the issues that we've come forward with, one that we did successfully pass last year was the consortium project, the Older Adult Services Consortium project that I believe Representative Thiessen was one of our chief authors, that allowed communities to identify their specific needs and to flesh out and to create some reforms for increasing access to care in a cost-effective way. That was one reform that we've brought forward. We've brought forward a package of reforms for the past several years in decreasing regulatory issues on home and community-based services and other such packages that we can get into that we've brought forward. And unfortunately, because of the upfront investment, have not had as much success as we'd like. We've also brought forward regulatory relief proposals. Some of that is a tough issue to crack. Because much of the regulatory issues, particularly with care centers, happen at the federal level. But we do spend a lot of time looking at regulatory relief in ways that we can streamline. And I know that informally, not to the legislature, but we are also, as organizations, working with the Department of Human Services on designing the care center of the future. I know Ms. Cullen is active on that group, and maybe that's a good place to trade off.
The other two areas I would add, Representative Murphy, is rebasing was a reform. It was only 2 years ago. Time flies when you're having fun in terms of rates and when it's fully implemented. That should hopefully address the core infrastructure, financial stability of the nursing facility as that part of the continuum. And the other issue that we brought forth in several iterations with Representative Thiessen's assistance is some long-term care financing reform. And I know Representative Berglund over the last, it's been 20 years, I think, has been looking at the issue of how do you pay for long-term care and that we need to come up with some new creative ways to do that. And that has been part of our reform initiatives for the last a long time.
Thank you. You know, Madam Chair, I just want to say that.
Senator Murphy, I thought when you asked your question, you were asking for reforms that would reduce spending, but I'm not sure.
Madam Chair and members, I think that we often talk about reform in the legislature that is going to provide a system that's going to meet the needs of the people of Minnesota more effectively, and often they will save money over time, but they take an upfront investment. And we spent, you know, a good 3 hours on the floor yesterday afternoon debating the bill that we passed and hearing a lot from our colleagues about healthcare costs being unsustainable. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing growth in healthcare costs is because our population is aging and we haven't figured out how to meet their needs very effectively. And that does call for reform, but I think the administration is mistaken if they think we can do that by just cutting. The cuts that we're talking about here, I think, exemplify not reform, but instead a blunt instrument, and they will have serious ramifications, and it will take us longer, I think, to get onto the path we need to go to meet the demands of the future. Thank you.
Well, I would just add this. In regard to my open door policy this session, for people to bring in ideas about reform that would save money, we did not turn people away if it required an upfront investment, as long as it did produce over time savings. In fact, with the veterans nursing homes, we were making a considerable upfront investment in order for them to become Medicare certified, but it did pay off in the second biennium. But I didn't hear any in this area. The folks we got our ideas from were the department in terms of long-term care savings. And they did require some investment also.
Right.
Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just planning on sitting back and listening to the testimony because I understand where this is going, but I took the bait. And I did have a bill this year that was developed with one of the administrators. I serve 12 nursing homes in my Senate district, and Deb Barnes from Parker Oaks. We came up with a pretty aggressive bill that dealt with critical access nursing homes, and Representative Thiessen, you had apparently a pretty good hearing on that, dealing with critical access nursing homes, equalization, private pay, and insurance issues, life insurance issues. I could not get a hearing. And that's really that's too bad. It's a shame, because we need to deal with these issues up front, and we cannot have these nursing homes closed like this, and they cannot take the brunt of this. I look forward to the conversation, Madam Chair, when we can start talking about the Health Care Access Fund, and I think that's going to have to be a part of this discussion.
Anything further? Any questions? Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond to what Representative Abler commented on, because a lot of times I think we try to make this simple. And this isn't simple. We can talk about equalization. Although it might have merits, equalization, if we went willy-nilly and just repealed it, it would cost the state of Minnesota more money. The governor wants to make it simple by saying, you know, let's just freeze things in the out biennium, and that results in a 33% cut. So while these numbers are dramatic, they could very much be the reality if we do what some are advocating around here, or just putting out the problem. And I get frustrated when we try to make this issue of caring for our most vulnerable an issue of simplicity, because it is not that. MA and nursing facility level of care is an entitlement, and that comes from the federal government, and we don't have a choice. If somebody qualifies, we have that responsibility. And we need to start talking about that, and not trying to make this something simple with just taking away equalization or saying freezing something, because it affects real people, and we can't. We have to face the realities of these dramatic numbers.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to just sit back too. And we did have a hearing on our Senator Rosen's bill, and it actually was a really good hearing, and we learned a lot. It's very difficult to actually understand what's going on in our nursing homes, because we hear about them as our nursing homes instead of individual nursing homes with different sets of criteria, and it's very hard to dig down into that information. And that's been a frustration for me, and I've expressed that frustration, because we can't really make good decisions when we're looking at nursing homes as some category of nursing homes. We got to understand better how their economics work on an individual level. So we're going to need that. But I also am a little – another frustration I have is that we sit here and talk about we as the government funding nursing homes and solving this long-term care problem. But the we is all of us in the state of Minnesota. And it was raised, the issue of actually getting people in this state to start saving their own money to help pay for their long-term care. And – that is the ultimate answer to solving this problem, because it is an entitlement. We want to keep people from getting to that entitlement, because nobody wants to spend their days having to spend themselves into poverty. And that's what we've set up a system to do. And we need to fundamentally change that. That's not going to solve our budget crisis today, this year. And one of my frustrations with this whole session, to be honest, and I have articulated this from the beginning, is that we've all been about putting on our green eye shades this year and solving this budget deficit instead of actually trying to think about how we're going to, and I'll take as much responsibility as that as anybody. But the ultimate answer to this problem is getting people to save their money. We have a culture where people don't save money, and that is what's going to solve the problem, so people don't have to get to the point where they're spending themselves into poverty. And so that's kind of a backwards way of actually complimenting you folks at the table, because you have come forward with some ideas about how we can switch that mentality, and that's the solution here. But in the current crisis that we're facing, that's going to take a long time to get to. That'll help the next generation, perhaps. But in the current crisis, there's no way around the fact whether this cut is 25% or whether this cut is 12%, it is going to cause a lot of pain. It's going to cause facilities to close. I think that's what we're, is that right? Our facility is going to close?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what does that mean when facilities close? That where do those people go? And we've talked about the facilities, we've talked about the employees, but what happens to when a facility closes? Just can you give me an example of what happens when a facility closes? Do all the people have to, the families have to come and pick up their loved ones and move them to another facility?
If I may, the way the process works is that the facility works with the ombudsman, the health department, DHS, the county, and puts together a plan for placing those elders in different facilities, typically skilled nursing facilities. So the challenge becomes, is there access for those people to even do that? So that would be the way the process would typically work. The employees, they try to find another job, or they go into another profession, which is, I think, one of the things that I'm concerned about is if we do some of these things, this 25% cut, we're going to push a whole group of people that are very caring people into other professions, and then who's going to care for the future? It kind of goes into your future look to it. But there is a process to the closure.
And Mr. Chair, just and I don't know if the witnesses have the answer, but I know a facility just closed. We're in Virginia or in Hibbing, one or the other.
Mr. Chair, Representative Teetson, Two Harbors.
Two Harbors is about to close.
And in Hibbing, correct.
Hibbing is already closed, right?
Yes.
Where did those? What happened there? Where did everybody go? What was the process?
The process, I think.
I know what the process was, but what was like the practical?
There was a group of facilities in the neighboring communities that accepted some of them. That happened to be a facility that specialized in care of behaviorally challenged individuals, and many facilities in the local communities could not care for them. So some of those residents were moved 50, 60, 75 miles away from their core home family. In that community, folks who had worked there, for the most part, they filled all the open positions in the neighboring facilities, and they got out of the business. So what you find is that if they had family members, the families are driving 1 hour, 2 hours to see their loved ones now because that's how far they were placed. This is one facility closing. If you have multiple facilities closing, for some of the closures, we have had a few unintentional consequences that happen, which is hospitalizations of people due to the stress of the closure and the stress of moving because they were frail seniors. We would anticipate that the hospitals, it would go upstream, that we would have folks entering hospitals at a time when they could be cared for in the communities.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and that's helpful, I think, for people to kind of get a sense in practical terms what happens. The cuts that we proposed in the bill we passed yesterday, are facilities going to are they going to close under that bill? Might some facilities close under? Well, we didn't drop much in those bills, did we? That was good. So what about if the cut is 12%, you said that we are going to see some facilities closing.
Absolutely.
And it's just going to get worse as we move to 15 and 20 and 25%. Is that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Teetson. And the numbers you saw on the sheet is the MA dollars. The facilities that would be most at risk are those that have the higher percentage of MA recipients. So the issue of closures is the higher you have an MA caseload in your facility, the greater likelihood you would be of closure.
Thank you. And if I can, in my facility, just to give you a sense of that, that's 73% of the people that we serve out of 407 residents. So it gives you a sense of that.
Other questions? Thank you all very much. Mm-hmm. Next, I'd like to call on Kevin Goodman, Mike Greenbaum. I believe they have someone else with them.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Greenbaum, and I'm with American Incorporated in Vadnais Heights and representing MNDACA. We have been looking at this from a proposal of a 3% cut, And with that, for facilities like ours at Merrick, that's going to really start cutting into the meat of the work and the jobs we do. If we look at cuts of 25%, you know, I would venture to say that the great, great majority of DT&H programs across the state of Minnesota would be forced to close almost immediately. I just don't think there's any way that programs like ourselves can withstand cuts to that extent. At 3%, we are, many programs, particularly in rural Minnesota, are already starting to have to borrow to meet payroll or in laying a number of employees off. And it's just, which is a very difficult scenario when we're talking about programs that are needing to meet ratio requirements to serve the individuals with disabilities. We at Merrick, along with others, have been able to withstand some of the COLA increases that have been less than inflationary cuts through trying to do increased fundraising, grant writing, and things like that, which, as you all know, in these current economic conditions become more and more difficult. So to be able to meet these cuts along with decreases in fundraising really force us to do things at looking at staffing and when we're already cutting things close from a ratio perspective. I've also have Jason Watson, who is an individual that we provide services to at Merrick. And what this means for him, and I'll let him talk about a little bit more, is the more staff we have to cut, the more difficult it becomes for us as an organization to have individuals out in the community looking for work opportunities. And it makes it more difficult for us to find the type of jobs that Jason is looking for and can do a very, very good job of doing. But as we have fewer staff, we're not able to get people out in the community looking for those new opportunities, looking for places where he can work, make wages, create wages, and pay taxes himself. Jason,
welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Yeah, I've been trying to find a job out in the community for a little over a year now. It's been tough, but I had one for a short time for the holidays. But with the proposed cuts, I wouldn't have a job or much income, so I'm gonna be stuck at home or somewhere else.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnell, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition, which is another organization that represents a number of day training and habilitation providers from throughout the state of Minnesota. Before I get into my testimony, I just wanted to ask a couple. I just received the copy of the amendment, and could ask some clarifying questions. I noticed that it's a blank percentage, but would this cut, the 25% proposal, be in addition to the 2.58% that DT&Hs are already scheduled to receive?
Yes, if I can just explain to you, we have our base bill that we've passed. Then we have the tax bill that was to fill in for additional deficit. And we're looking at what we do if we don't get those revenues.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question is, I see it says except for regional centers, and I'm unclear exactly what that refers to. Is that the SOX, or was that... is that facilities located in regional centers?
Maybe when Mr. Gill gets back, we can clarify that.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll go on with my testimony. DT&H programs, there's about 285 licensed DT&H programs throughout the state with a capacity of nearly 13,000 individuals that can be served in those programs. DT&H is day training and habilitation providers provide or key part of community-based services for people with developmental disabilities. Just to give you an example, the individuals will be living either in their individual house, group homes, or ICFMRs. What a day training and habilitation provider does is we'll pick them up in the morning from their facility. It's door-to-door service. Take them to a work site if they're able to or have a job. May take them to a work center if it's work-centered or center-based work that they're doing. or for those that are most fragile or medically needy, or even some of the elderly, we have programs for those folks as well. It may just be day activities off-site from their residential facility where those day services are provided. So it doesn't always necessarily mean work, because some people are so medically fragile that we don't have that level of care or that level of service, and they're not going to be able to do on-site jobs in the community. So we have a full array of people that we service with a full array of services that we provide to them. But one of the key components and one of the key values to DT&H is it does provide a check and balance system for our vulnerable adults in Minnesota. If things are happening in the residential facility, a lot of times those are found out at the day training facility, and vice versa. If things are happening at the day training facility or with the provider, the residential facility can pick up on it. So it's part of the vulnerable adults and how we manage that system. Now, with regard to the cuts, right now, Mike had made the comment about the impact and that a number of DT&H providers are currently borrowing money to continue their services and providing services in the state. If you go any deeper than that, and with even a 3% cut, you will see programs close. And at 25%, I can't imagine any one of the programs that I represent could keep their doors open, because the margins that they're working under right now just aren't enough in order to keep their doors open. If the cut was less than 25%, you would be looking at issues such as how do you contain costs. You look at what your main costs are, transportation and employee costs. So you'd have to figure out ways of reducing those costs. I mentioned medically fragile people, where their programs are the most costly, where they lose the most money, they'll be the first programs to go. And typically it'd be in the medically fragile, maybe the elderly, and then also the more intensive support services that are needed in the community-based services, those would go. But quite frankly, if you get a very deep cut at all, you're just not going to have the services at all, and these folks will be staying at home. And so the whole issue, and then it becomes an issue of community-based services. Are you really encouraging, are you really fulfilling the mandate of the need to have community-based services out there? Quite frankly, I think you'll have an Olmstead problem, and not with the county, but with the case. And that will be a whole other issue that you have to deal with at this level. So bad things will happen with that larger cut, and none of them are good.
Can someone explain to us, when you say you're borrowing to meet your payroll, how long, I mean, even under a 3% scenario, how long can you keep borrowing to meet your payroll?
Well, it's difficult for me to answer an organization-specific question for other organizations in the metro or in the state of Minnesota. You know, my assumption is that they're borrowing on lines of credit or something like that, where they're borrowing short-term until their reimbursement come back, payback, and that gets more and more difficult as time goes on, because that really makes the ability to carry on your services very, very negligible. And you can't, and again, as you all know, the ability to be able to borrow is decreasing significantly. So it makes a very, very difficult scenario for those organizations that are in that position, having to borrow just even to meet payroll and continue with their ongoing operations. They're having to borrow to meet that payroll, and if they are to cut staff, as Mr. Goodenow mentioned, then you're in jeopardy of not meeting those ratio requirements that we're all mandated to maintain as well.
And can you tell us what your average wage is?
It's very similar that we're talking about the nursing home for Merrick. And, you know, we're, again, a metro organization, but we're in that probably low $11 range for our direct staff. So a 25% cut would put primarily, you know, every individual that we're employing underneath significantly poverty lines.
So you'd be talking about possible $8 wages.
That would be the ballpark, yeah.
Mr. Goodenow?
Madam Chair, if I could just mention a couple other things. The day training and habilitation providers are all nonprofits, and basically all their revenues are pretty exclusively public revenues. So we don't have the ability to shift to private pay. It's you are the payer.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Next, I'd like to call on Tony Carter. Ramsey County Commissioner.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you again. I'm Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner, and I'm here to speak with you on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and our affiliates, which represents all 87 counties in Minnesota. As you know, counties administer most of the public health and human services through contracts or directly, and as such, any cuts, any additional cuts, will have a direct impact on our counties, on our county operations, and, of course, on those that we serve in our communities. Realizing that between a rock and a hard place that you all are in attempting to preserve our safety net services, I just want to thank you for the efforts that you've made in your proposal. We want also to just remind you, as we came in early, to share with you principles for meeting our budget deficit in this time period at the beginning of the session of those principles. And so these are those that we laid out at the beginning of the session. One, don't destroy the basic safety net for people in need. And counties are that basic safety net. And two, during these hard times, don't demolish the social services and public health infrastructure to the point where we won't be able to rebuild it when eventually the economy does recover. Three, don't make budget decisions that will create worse tails in future years because we have neglected to invest in important evidence-based prevention. Don't shift cost to local government, creating more inequity across the state because of greater reliance on property taxes. And do recognize that the state has a responsibility to identify revenues in order to assure equal access across the state to essential statewide services. Without those new state revenues, counties will bear the responsibility through increased property taxes. I'm thankful to you again for your commitment, and also want to thank you for bearing this responsibility, even though all tools aren't on the table, to enable you to address potentially devastating effects of additional cuts. Your conference committee was successful in honoring the principles laid out to the extent the current budget reality allows. If we're forced to make deeper cuts, we risk jeopardizing the most basic health and human services infrastructure. The cuts in consideration, including reductions to facilities and to hospital reimbursements and funding, concern us greatly as they do threaten to devastate our ability to care for our safety net. We will hear, perhaps in the next testimony, about the impact to our hospitals. An assessment from Regions Hospital lets us know the horrendous impact of these upcoming cuts in consideration. Our nursing home alone in Ramsey County would suffer a $1.7 million reduction from the effects you've been talking about. And across the state, the $225 million reduction due to those rate reimbursement cuts would impact I don't know how many of your and my and other grandmothers and grandfathers who are currently utilizing those services. And with cuts in areas such as these, we know that we are looking not just at those nursing homes or those hospitals, but we are, as others have said, also looking at community-based alternatives which are in place to help us prevent more costly placements. The familiar analogy of the balloon pressured at one end bursting completely at the other comes to mind. When we visited earlier, we asked that during this difficult economic time, you would take the time, you would take this opportunity to be courageous in making the kinds of policy changes that are doubly difficult during more prosperous times. And I thank you for the inclusion of the Service Delivery Redesign Initiative that is included in the current conference committee report. That is one such example that actually transforms the current human services delivery system in a way that will lead to long-term cost savings and a more efficient delivery system. Lastly, I hope that in the coming days, in your discussions and in your deliberations across the legislature and with the governor, that you will find ways to support a sustainable system to maintain our safety net and to also make the types of bold policy changes that will lead us to the type of results and outcomes that we all want. So I thank you and just ask that you consider our principles and our needs during these difficult times.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And please stay. I have a question for you. Please stay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for calling on the next
Commissioner Carter, thank you very much. I was listening to the debates over our Health and Human Services bill that we passed in the legislature yesterday, both in the House and the Senate. And those who were opposed to the bill were talking about the growth, even with these cuts that we've passed, in the cost to the welfare programs of the state. And that, in fact, that growth over a period of 4 years is about 20%, even with these cuts. And the charge is that we cannot sustain that. We cannot continue to do that. What is your reaction to that, and what are your suggestions for what we can do within your sphere of influence to, as it relates to these, to respond to that charge that we need to do deeper cuts because we cannot sustain that kind of growth?
Well, certainly, first of all, what we call the welfare system is only a very small percentage of the types of needs that we are meeting. You know, the larger costs are those costs that we have been talking about, such as nursing home costs and costs that fund people with disabilities that are staying in facilities that we have to care for. And it is certainly our obligation to do that. Given that there are increases across the board, you know, we see them when we buy bread at the grocery store. We want to make certain that we don't pin the increase on abuse or lack of need. We all need to eat. But we do want to make certain that we design effective and efficient services so that they can be delivered in ways that produce the kinds of outcomes that we need. As I mentioned, the AMC and MAXA redesign proposal is one way of making certain that we are able to do so with partners working together to increase the efficiency and effectiveness of the services they deliver. I think we've got a lot of work to do there, and I do believe that the proposal coming forward enables us to do that kind of work, breaking down silos, ensuring that we are addressing the needs, but doing so in the most efficient ways is the direction that I believe we all want to go in. Clearly, it's difficult for us, and without the types of tools and resources before us in the short term, we make decisions that are disadvantageous to us in the longer term and create bigger and bigger problems for us to address. So I believe in the short term, we need to be focused on the best solutions. Does that address your question?
Any other questions? Thank you again.
Thank you very, very much.
Jeff Barsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee. My name is Jeff Barsh. I'm here representing Health Partners in Regents Hospital. And Mike Haristoff from Hennepin County Medical Center will join me to maybe save a little time. First thing I want to do is thank the members of this Conference Committee for the conference report that was passed out previously. I don't think there's anyone here, any constituency, that is happy with the cuts that are in that bill. I'd include all of you in that, but I think your approach was thoughtful and equitable. And I think everyone here appreciates that. More importantly and most importantly, I think the conference report that was previously passed preserved eligibility for our state public programs. That's a priority that you've made, and it's our priority as well. When we look at the amendment that's before us today, we've been asked what would the impact of this be if this amendment were adopted. I can tell you, quite frankly, that the impact of that ratable reduction to Regents Hospital would be devastating. And it would be a devastating impact to our patients, both public program and commercial, and our ability to serve them. Regents Hospital is the safety net hospital for the East Metro. And I don't use the term safety net to suggest that all hospitals aren't safety nets. They are. And all hospitals are seeing that role, or their role as a safety net, increase as people are losing health care coverage in the commercial market, and they're seeing more and more uncompensated care. I use that term only to distinguish Regents because we see a disproportionate share of people on state public programs or who are uninsured in the East Metro. So simply put, when these cuts are made to affect the reimbursement for state public programs, they impact us and others like us to a greater extent. Again, when you look at the impact of the total cut through this ratable reduction, I'm not sure how we can absorb it. I know many of you have asked this repeatedly this session. What would you have to do to absorb cuts in this magnitude? And we've been reluctant to be specific because those aren't easier fun answers. But hopefully I can be a little bit more clear today in terms of some of the steps we might have to take. We have been lucky over the last couple years in that Regents has grown in terms of our business. We've had a 6% growth in terms of patient days. But at the same time, we're seeing the same pressures that everyone else has, and we've had a hiring freeze in place, meaning just like all other hospitals, we were treating more patients with less staff. To add this type of ratable reduction on top of that would have a dramatic impact. And basically, we would have to look at every non-revenue service that we provide and re-examine whether or not we would be able to continue to provide it. And some examples of some of the non-revenue services, community support, the support that we give in grants and other outreach to groups like the community clinics, the Portico Health Net, those agencies that are trying to help people get coverage. Some of the outpatient services we provide specifically targeted to populations in the East Metro, are Hmong and other populations that reach out to and we try to serve in an outpatient basis. Our wound clinic, OB services, we actually provide a significant and a majority of the deliveries for community clinics in the East Metro at a loss. And then we start getting to some things that are really difficult to even talk about in terms of mental health. We're the largest inpatient provider of mental health services in the East Metro. We also do a lot of work outpatient. We are a partner in Hovander House, which is a residential treatment facility we operate to keep people out of the hospital. Again, we operate that facility at a loss. We are partners with Health East and United and others for the Mental Health Drug Assistance Program. This is a program the hospitals put together to provide 24/7 access to mental health patients in crisis so they can get their medications. It's something we have all invested in to help those patients. Again, we're going to have to evaluate all of these programs to see if we can continue them. Trauma. We are the only level one trauma center in the East Metro. Operating a trauma center is an expense. You have to have surgeons on staff 24 hours a day to be able to do that. What happens if the only trauma center in the East Metro goes away? All of these things, all of these services are tied to jobs. So, again, any reduction or any thought of reevaluating our ability to provide these services comes with potential job loss. The other thing we might have to consider, which would be very difficult, is to look at the charity care we provide outside of Ramsey County. We provide charity care to citizens across the state of Minnesota, in Wisconsin, and Iowa. We have an obligation to the residents of Ramsey County, and we'll maintain that until we literally have to close the door. But if we continue to see, or if we're able to see cuts like this alongside the growth in uncompensated care, it's something that we regretfully would have to consider. And I think the hardest sell would be to the providers, particularly in our ED. They'd probably be not compliant, but as an organization, those are the kinds of things we would have to do to be able to stay open and treat the patients that we want to treat. Everyone understands that these types of cuts can impact people who are on public programs, but I'd like to point out again that these cuts don't just affect the people who are on public programs, but they affect all of us. The services I mentioned are available to people who are on public programs and who get their insurance through commercial insurance. That's what we're looking at. And when we talk about growth in uncompensated care and we talk about the ability to treat people without insurance, a lot of the people we're talking about and a growing portion of the people we're talking about are people who are working, who are trying to provide for their families, particularly in this tough economy. They don't yet qualify for a public program, and they're really one medical event away from bankruptcy or financial ruin or having to enroll in one of the programs. These are the people that these types of cuts are really going to hurt, those people who are struggling every day to make ends meet, and oftentimes it's a trip to the hospital where it's a significant discount or free care that allows them to continue to work and earn a wage and contribute. So I just want to remind the committee and others that we're not just talking about the people who are on the programs that are served by state government, but really we're talking about the impact that these types of changes can have to everyone. With that, I'd be happy to any questions or let Mr. Harrisfall speak.
Are there any questions?
In time. Thank you, Senator Berglund. I would like you to speak to this challenge that I've heard on the floor of both the Senate and the House about that the cuts, even the ones we have so far, are really not in the base. There are cuts in the growth, and that in fact that our actions are not creating a solution to cost containment, which is not this growth is not sustainable. And so as if these cuts are not real cuts. And what you are talking about here are what the consequences of these are, that they are real cuts. But the discussion then moves over into whether or not, in terms of a budgetary process, if they're cuts in the base or they're cuts in the growth. So I'd like to hear what you might be able to do in terms of guidance for us about dealing with that issue.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the way we look at this is obviously from our own eyes, and what we're looking at is a significant loss in the reimbursement that comes with the patients that we serve and in a growing number of patients that we serve who are on public programs. So, yes, to us, they are deep, deep cuts. In terms of guidance to the legislature, as you think about it, obviously I'd like you to look at it through my eyes, and I'd like all of you to do so in terms of really understanding what it is the facilities around the state are looking at. Hopefully that would provide some guidance in terms of next steps and how to move forward. Beyond that, you know, I can think about it a little bit more, but your statement was correct in that we view these as cuts, cuts that we will see and that will impact our ability to serve.
Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barsh, the governor's bill probably looks pretty good after this. Can you tell me what the governor's cuts were to hospitals compared to what this proposal is?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, this may come as a shock to you, but the 20% rateable reduction is actually better impact for us than the governor's proposed budget. The biggest difference in that comes from the loss of eligibility. The destruction of the General Assistance Medical Care Program is absolutely devastating to Regents Hospital and to Hennepin County Medical Center. I think between our two institutions, it's about 65% of the GMC patients in the state. In addition to that, the losses to Minnesota Care truly, truly are devastating to hospitals. Someone coming in with a really bad payment is better than someone coming in with no payment. And in addition, the people who stay on a program have access to clinical services, which will keep them from entering a more aggressive state of sickness where they will see services at the emergency room. So it may sound outrageous, but the governor's proposal is much more devastating to us than what we see here before us today.
Other questions? Representative Huntley.
Either one of you, is there any requirement that you have to have mental health beds in a hospital?
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, I don't believe there is.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to know if Mr. Barsh could talk with us a little bit about the progress that you've been making either at Regions or in Health Partners on the reform efforts that we engaged in last session and what you're seeing as a result of that progress.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, we, along with I would say almost every healthcare institution in the state, has been working with the Department of Health in particular to really fast-track implementation of reform. They're under some very aggressive timelines, which I think are appropriate given our need, in order to fast-track the development of medical homes, to fast-track the development of statewide quality reporting, et cetera. They're things we're engaged with the department.
Thank you.
I would say in addition to that, our organization is looking to work with other partners outside of the legislatively approved process in order to do many of those things. We were just approved by NCQA as a medical home provider under their designation. We're also working with a number of other systems to do creative payment reform pilots, whether it's bundled payments or baskets of care, or entering into a number of discussions with them around total cost of care, which I know was a piece of the reform discussion last year that didn't quite make it to the end game. So we agree with the direction that was laid out by the legislature, and we and others are actively working toward it.
And Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, there's an article that's being distributed right now to you that was published in the New York Times on Saturday. And it has to do with some of the reforms that Minnesota engaged in last session. And it does, I think, it talks about what they're looking at a federal level. But it really draws attention to what we began to work on as a result of what we're learning at Park Nicollet, that if we coordinated care and did a better job at the front end of care coordination, we would save money. And the federal government is looking at that now. That is the medical home model, and that is total cost of care. The problem that I think that we're having, and Senator Berglund, this speaks to the hard work that you've done this session, is that we're having a difficult time with the administration getting fiscal notes that show savings for these programs. So we're left with making fairly difficult choices like deep ratable reductions, because we can't get a savings through the fiscal noting process that show if we do a better job of reforming care delivery, we will get those savings and they'll show up on our spreadsheets. So I know the I don't think the department's here right now, but
we hope they're still working for us.
I hope they are as well. But again, we've been hearing, unsustainable health care costs and not very much reform. And I think we embarked on what I would describe as very thoughtful and analytical reform of the delivery system, and we need to continue to pursue that, and we need the department and the administration to join us as partners to begin to produce the savings that we know are there. And this article is a demonstration of that. I want to thank you for your continued work on that. I hope we don't have to go to the place that we're talking about right now, because I know that's going to slow those reforms down. And it's just going to bust up what we've done. But I'll also challenge you to continue to pursue it, because it will, I know it will, provide better care for better value. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, why don't we go on then?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, Jeff said just about everything that I wanted to say, so I'll just give you a little bit of a perspective about Hennepin County Medical Center's look at things. And I would just say, first of all, that Hennepin County Medical Center basically budgets to break even. And having about 43% of our volume of Minnesota healthcare programs and 30% Medicare, as a taxpayer, I appreciate the fiscal stewardship. The kinds of cuts that either were anticipated in the governor's budget or even the proposal that we've seen today, I would probably say that we see them as just about equally damaging to our institution and what we're trying to do for the people that we serve. But I would certainly agree with Jeff. It is about eligibility foremost. A covered life is going to generally be a healthier life, and it's going to be a more productive person going forward. So we really embrace what the legislature has done with respect to eligibility. At Hennepin, we have been fairly circumspect about program closures and reductions. We've done lots of things around belt tightening in anticipation of what has happened during the last legislative session, the unallotment, and now what may come out of this legislative session. We're very concerned about talking about program reduction, program closure. That's why we're there. Kind of by definition, Hennepin County Medical Center exists to serve those who have no place else to go. So we've been very reluctant to come forward with those things. I can tell you that whether it's a $25 million to $40 million reduction in our revenues on a break-even operation, we will not be the Hennepin that you have known, which is providing over almost 200,000 primary care visits, over 125 primary care physicians in training, not to mention all the specialty work, trauma services, and so on that Hennepin County Medical Center provides. So I really would echo the things that that Jeff has said today, and certainly I'm happy to respond to any questions you may have.
I had a colleague yesterday ask me if you wouldn't just levy to make it up. If you wouldn't just get the county to levy to make it up.
Madam Chair, I don't know all the intricacies of what Hennepin County can or can't do along those lines. I do know that this year Hennepin County has already increased the amount of support to the hospital by 15%. I don't know what other kinds of ceilings the county is has to live within, but I do know that as we've talked about our challenges, the county is gravely concerned about the impact on Hennepin County Medical Center as to what's happening this session.
So you believe the levy limits that are in place would prohibit the county from providing more assistance than they have already?
Madam Chair, I think that, but I acknowledge I don't know that for sure.
Madam Chair. Are there other questions? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Harrisdahl, it's my understanding the dollar amount that the property taxes are going in to subsidize Hennepin County Medical Center are in the order of $30 to $40 million a year. Do you get us those numbers?
Sure.
That was from like 2 years ago.
Yes, this coming year there will be $32 million of tax support in response to our particular issues around uncompensated care. In addition to that, the county does provide capital funding and financing for capital projects at the institution in any given year. Those can be substantial and eight figures, but certainly I can give you the legacy of the specific tax support to help us with uncompensated care.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Sharon.
I don't know that you can respond to this, but this discussion about the utilization of local levy or the expectation that property taxes become, again, another solution for the state's abandonment of its responsibility is something that I think we should look at very closely. Hennepin County or in my community, Mankato, cannot be expected, I think, alone to carry on through its narrow property tax base the obligation for the entire region in our case, or for the state. You certainly serve a broader base of persons, especially because you provide an educational program for nurses as well as physicians. You have multiple functions and roles in the state, and so this concept of going to property taxes reduces the size of the geographic area that's responsible for underwriting those costs. And I think there's a real. I think that should be strongly challenged before we accept that as a solution to what we're talking about here.
Senator Sharon, I wasn't suggesting it be a solution.
No, I didn't think you were. I understood clearly that you're laying out, as I am by my questions, what people are saying about and distracting us from. Recognizing the seriousness of the problem and suggesting that there are alternatives out there that that are not there for us other than the ones that Representative Murphy's talking about, which really requires us to have a good fiscal note and make real reform in the system, which we're not doing.
Rep. Sam Huntley.
Well, Senator Sharon and Madam Chair, I was, we could make our budget look really good, not lose a penny of federal money. If we just got rid of GAMC, that would save us about $700 million a year and make our budget look really good. We'd have $300 million than we thought we had. The trouble is those people don't go away.
That's right.
They're still going to be here in the state, and they're still going to go to Hennepin County Medical Center. They're still going to go to Regions. And they'll still be treated there under the worst possible circumstances in emergency rooms. So we can make our budget look really good, but we haven't done anything to help the state.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, I guess I'll say something.
Senator Coring.
And both of the testifiers, you don't need to respond to this if you don't want to, but I guess I'm you know, I'm trying to, you know, all we, I can see what's happening, you know, there's the will of some people that want to, we just have to raise revenue, And my question is let's say we raise revenue now because we don't want anything to change. People don't like things to change. I'm one of them. So let's say the economy does not get any better and we get through this next biennium and then we're in the next biennium and we've raised taxes a billion or whatever we raise it and we get in the next biennium. So then we just go and we raise them again. And so my question to everybody in this room is, you know, how much is enough? And how much can we raise taxes before it's just too much? You know, a lot of the businesses, and I'm sorry about making this statement, but I just have to do it. I've paid my $100, as Senator Day said, so to run for office so I can say it. But, you know, what do I say to the people that have lost their jobs in my district and the people that have taken a reduction in their wages, but yet I see everybody, a lot of people coming up here, and my God, they don't want anything to change. They just want to continue on, and it's going to be, I don't know. I just think that this continually notion that we can't solve this budget crisis without raising taxes, I don't know if I necessarily buy into that. So, and this notion that we're going to put everything on property taxes, you know, cities and counties, you know, just because it's easy, I guess, to continue business as usual and just to levy more property tax, they don't have to do that. But anyway, I'm just kind of rambling, but I've for the last 5 months, I've heard people come up here and it's just, oh my God, it's the end of the world. But I think we just have to, reprioritize and do things different. You know, do you ever think about, you know, maybe workers might have to take maybe a pay reduction? I think we might have to do that here. My legislative assistant, we have to adjust our budget here. Our legislative assistants might have to take a furlough day or they might have to take a reduction in their pay. I don't know, and I think that they'll be happy to do that just so that they can continue on with the job. So, anyway, trying to give you another side of the story rather than just hearing a one-sided story, and that's what we continually hear here. So.
Mr. Parrish.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, couple comments in response. First is hospitals are employers. In fact, hospitals are large employers and some of the largest employers in their communities, particularly in greater Minnesota. And so when you talk about pay cuts or furloughs or wage decreases or hiring freezes, those are all things that hospitals are experiencing just as well as every other business in the state is experiencing. So we're certainly not up here asking for the status quo because that's not what we're able to live. When you mention the idea of doing things differently, I think those go back to Representative Murphy's comments, which is that we're all trying to do things very differently in healthcare that focus on efficient delivery of care, the right care at the right time, reforming our payment system, and so that we get away from paying for volume and pay for outcomes and pay for care. And so we are absolutely invested in that and trying to work hard toward it. My last comment would be, you know, you mentioned some of your constituents who might be forced to lose their job or be laid off. And I guess one of my comments back to you would be, right now, if that individual gets sick or gets in an accident, they have a hospital to go to, and that hospital will care for them. And what we're trying to suggest today is that some of the budget solutions that have been proposed threaten the ability of that hospital to be there for that person. And those are the comments that we're trying to make.
Representative Huntley.
Just a response, Madam Chair, to Representative Coring. If you watch the evening news tonight or read the paper tomorrow morning, you'll find out that Park Nicollet is announcing they're laying off 250 people. And that's 250 people that won't be paying taxes. And this is the plus they're closing clinics. And this is the same hospital that was featured in the New York Times on Saturday as being one of the best hospitals in the country for reducing healthcare spending. And the trouble with this article is it points out that if they do that, and this is exactly the same thing that SMDC did in terms of congestive heart failure, they lose money by doing what's right. And today, when that press report comes out, you will be shocked at what's happened to Park Nicollet.
And
this is before our cuts.
I believe that's on top of 200 that they laid off last fall.
Mr. Madam
questions?
Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, just Representative Huntley's point, which just points out the need for us to continue to work inside of the system and to reward progress and quality. And I'm trying to be good about the premise for our meeting today, so I'm not even going to spend much time on that. I mentioned that earlier. But the real work of this committee, which I thought was very well done for 14 days consecutively, of being together, even on Mother's Day, that was kind of interesting. Still squinting from that day, like, you know, tired red eyes. But I think this committee has established kind of a tradition in those 14 days and over the years of trying to get at the real issues. And I hope that maybe, if nothing else about this meeting today, it spurs us on to more of that. If this is the absolute worst outcome we can think of, if we just go crazy and balance the budget totally thoughtlessly and on just on two lines or on one page of amendment, then that's the worst case scenario that ever could happen. There's a way better scenario we can force to happen. We talked about getting RVUs with the department and forcing people to reward primary care more. We've heard about St. Mary's, I think, 15 times over the years about how they get paid less to do better work. We're the people that set the state policy. These people in the room are the best they could find on either side of the House and Senate to work on that. And so just to call us to where the real issue is, and it's not because Park Nicollet was wasting money, but because they were too lean. At my clinic, our rates are lean. We try to stay open. And some clinics are far more abusive of extending treatment plans, and they make a lot of money. And so how do we, the question, I think, in round two, and there needs to be some kind of a round two, hopefully not the whole bill, hopefully just a 50-page version where we have some target to hit. That part, hopefully it'll include something about how do we tell them to do something today different for Park and for St. Mary's? And how does the state, as we run ourselves, decide not to be part of the problem in that, but in part of the solution? And I've been thinking of ideas, Senator Bergman, you've been thinking of ideas, other people have been thinking of ideas. Let's throw them all against the wall and see how many we can force this to be done, savings or not. Because part of this is driven by tails. And you know that we're right on some of those ideas we got. And the department just can't quite come up with the savings. We know they're there, they can't give us credit. And so we can't do them or we don't do them because they cost $1 million. Well, let's spend $1 million to save the 10 we know is going to come on the tails. And then half of this, none of this that we bring forward is even going to get near to happening because we'll protect the parks. We'll punish the ones that are wasting the money by taking away their money that they're wasting. And at least if somebody has to close, it will be not Park. It'd be some hospital or some clinic or some group of physicians that can't manage their budgets at all, that are squandering money on wasted treatments and valueless care. And we'll have more of St. Mary's and more of Parks around. And if the system right-sizes, it'll be around right-sizing around people who are doing good work and that care about the people and give a value. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler, there are a handful of fiscal notes that we hope will materialize in the next day or two. I would be the most pleased person in the universe if they produce $400 million.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, and what I'm suggesting is we do our whatever. We don't know the job is $400 million or if it's $10. There's no target assigned to us yet, as I understand.
Well, there are numbers that are needed to balance the budget. But and as I said, if we go home and we don't balance the budget, my experience is that we will do some of the $400 million this year. We'll do some of the $400 million next year. And we'll do some of the $400 million the year after that.
And, Madam Chair, I'm not even arguing about the number, but I'm saying we'll get a number sometime. we'll hit that target however we do, and this committee will do it as thoughtfully as possible, hopefully to shield groups, not as this proposal would bring forward, which is shielding no one. And I understand the point of today. But I think that we should do those anyway. If we can't get a fiscal note, but if you and I in the committee says, you know, this probably is going to save some money, so let's just pass it anyway, short of a savings, because you know, we live in a world of tails. You know, 13 is going to come, and 14 is going to come. And if we do the things now we know are good to do, if we reward St. Mary's and even pay money to do that and reward Park in ways that enhance rates or steering people there or whatever, in the tails we're going to win. That we're suffering the effects of tail decisions 5 years ago that we couldn't do. That's what we're paying for, madam. It's not for lack of ideas. We just got to do it. So thanks,
Representative Abler, we do have some of that language in our bill. But on the other hand, when we bring a spreadsheet to the floor of the House and Senate, we have to have numbers that we actually have gotten fiscal notes for in the bill. And, you know, if that means rate cuts because we don't have alternatives, then folks like those at the table have to go back and make decisions to end programs. And you know, I have never seen us buy a rate cut back. I'll just say that flat out. I've never seen it happen.
Madam Chair, just to finish that, and then I'll stop. But I'm just saying, by doing what you and I know, and Representative Huntley and other people have thought of ideas, Gottwald, whatever, all these ideas that are swirling around, some work, some don't, I don't know about all the ideas. But the forecast will be lower because of it. And so the targets will have a sudden surplus in this part that we would have been surprised about that didn't show in what we had to manage. That's what I'm telling you. So we drive the forecast lower because of our actions. Had we done nothing, the forecast would be worse. If nothing had ever happened in your innovations, we'd be spending even more money than what we are. So I'm done. Thanks.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few things to Representative Abler and Senator Coring's comments and trying to put into perspective of what we're dealing with today. We just recently received testimony that 20.35% rate reduction is not as bad as some of the proposals that are out there. A 20.35% rate reduction. And when we talked about taxes, and I just did the math here, the proposal that was recently vetoed for somebody making $300,000 a year would pay 0.0019% more. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the difference of minutia percentages to protect some of our most vulnerable, those with mental health issues, those who are going to be sick, regardless if they have GAMC or not, for 0.0019%.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to respond that to what Representative Abler was saying, because on many points we agree. And I agree that we need to figure out how to push forward the things that we know that will save money in the tails. But we also have to recognize that if we do cuts that undermine those reforms, and the cuts, I think, especially to the hospitals, but also to in long-term care, if we do cuts to community-based services, it undermines the very progress we're trying to make. By shifting the costs and putting pressure on those facilities so they're not going to be able to continue to pursue the reforms. That's why I think it's important for us to talk about, you know, if we have to do another $400 million in cuts, whether we do it thoughtfully or if we concentrate it where the money is, because Willie Sutton says you go where the money is, we run the real risk of undermining and pushing forward those costs and blowing up our tails. And I think that if we only talk about cuts or no cuts, and we don't recognize the cost of both of those things because they both have costs, and balance them, we're going to have trouble. This biennium, the healthcare system is going to struggle, and we're going to have financial struggles going forward. So I really want to urge us to break out of the ideological argument about no cuts. And because I don't think we're arguing that. We've already done $500 million of cuts. So I want to reject those who are saying we're not willing to talk about cuts. And then I think we have to talk about what it means if we only balance this budget with no more revenue, because that is going to cause a lot of difficulty down the line as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot being discussed here, and
I just like to make the point that hospitals are a business, and I have a tremendous amount of faith in those CEOs that are running the business. And we handed them a fairly aggressive health reform package last year, and they are running this business. They are going through the motions of realigning this business. We need to give them the tools to realign. Now, I feel bad about the 200 jobs that are being lost and the 200 jobs a while ago that were being lost for Park Nicollet. That's terrible. But this is how business is run. There is attrition. There is job loss. And you move forward so you can keep moving the business forward.
Good.
I think it's most important that we continue on with this healthcare reform. And we keep talking about the most vulnerable. Well, let's have a discussion about what is the most vulnerable. I mean, and at some point, members, we are going to have a very honest, thanks, open talk about our health care access fund. And it's geared toward the most vulnerable. But I'm sorry, I still think the elderly in our nursing homes and our hospitals, too, but mostly those long-term care facilities, are the most vulnerable also. And I cannot figure out why we're only spending, in 06 and 09, we only spent $48 million out of the Health Care Access Fund. And in FY 10 and 13, we're going to spend $50 million. But right now, the actual funding for 10 and 11 is $1 million out of the Health Care Access Fund. Now, why can't we use that for health care, for our most vulnerable, for our long-term care facilities, for our disabled? Why does it have to be for public people that are on public assistance? I don't understand that. So, at some point, Madam Chair, we are going to have that discussion about the definition of this health care access fund. And I think the time is now, because obviously the long-term care facilities have ran their business so tight they are taking away their health insurance to make the bottom line meet. And hospitals are getting to that point. But, when you have Mr. Barsh say that this proposal is better than the governor's, well, that's pretty telling that the governor's was pretty bad. I will agree. But I'm not disputing that. But we really need to start looking at, do we need to have a $240 million excess in the health care access fund? And we're talking about closing long-term care facilities or letting
Senator
some of our
Rosen,
hospitals
would you
close.
Would you support the idea of expanding the provider tax to nursing homes and other long-term care providers? They don't pay the provider tax now.
Madam Chair, I think we ought to have that discussion, and I think it should be right on the table, absolutely. And I think we ought to talk about expanding that provider tax as a whole, Madam Chair.
Senator Berger?
Senator Sharon.
I know you want, I guess there are other people who would like to come and testify today, I suppose,
yes,
other than
are.
Us.
Yes, there are. We have a list here, yes.
I just want to respond to a couple of things
and
that
Senator
Rosen
said. And we will have time
said.
For our committee discussion, so maybe we can let these gentlemen be excused.
As they're being excused, I simply want to say that when we're talking about the loss of jobs in the hospital and the nursing homes, et cetera, and that's what happens within business, I think that we have to talk about the reality that in business you lay people off because nobody's coming in the door to buy your product. But in government, when we're laying off people and there are more people coming in the door with uncompensated care, it creates a substantially different kind of an environment economically. And so they can't really recover from the layoff of the employees. They continue to have to expend dollars, especially hospitals, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in case somebody needs it. And I think that Senator Rosen's discussion about let's talk about health care access fund is important. It's maybe a way to go and look at some solution, but it is, in my mind, not so much different than property taxes. In this regard, that we're asking a small group of people, a targeted group of people, to carry the burden through that particular form of taxation on a narrow group that really should be supported by a broader and more general tax. And that will be a part of that discussion when we get to it.
Mary Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. and the members of the committee. My name is Mary Edwards, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for the Fairview Health Services. We have 7 hospitals, including the University of Minnesota Medical Center. We are the largest teaching hospital in the state. Fairview employs 22,000 people. We're the largest provider of Medicaid services in the state. Conference Committee, thank you very much for your work that you did over the weekend and what you did yesterday in passing the bill. Given the difficult budget situation, the proposal preserved the vital programs with eligibility and maintained core funding. I am very concerned about $400 million more coming out of Health and Human Services. It makes me shudder. In April, Fairview, we shared our financial results of 2008. We reported a loss of $114 million. Patient volumes were down as people were laid off, and our uncompensated care increased 17%, up to $85 million in 2008. In order to absorb this particular situation, we've already taken strong actions. We've dramatically changed our pension, our paid time off. We are having no annual pay increases. We've asked our unions to consider no pay increases. We've eliminated 500 positions. We're trying to find ways to work more efficiently. We're trying to reduce supply expenses. We're reducing staff and expenses in non-clinical areas such as human resources and IT. And with the unprecedented changes in our economy and the collapse of the capital market, which is also an important part of the discussion, we cannot absorb any more cuts without a dramatic change in the nature and scope of our services that we provide to the community. Healthcare is a service industry. Our single largest expense is salaries and benefits. Very simply put, cuts in our funding will mean job losses. We would also look at closing programs, reducing access to services. At Fairview, we'd like to first look at programs that already lose money. Services such as mental health, chemical dependency, and emergency services. In 2008 alone, we lost $8 million in our behavioral services. We are the largest behavioral services in the upper Midwest. We believe this is core to our mission to continue to provide these services, which improves the health of the communities we serve. As is evident in the fact that we own the University of Minnesota Hospital, we support education and research through our partnership with them. We provide clinical hands-on training for everyone who flows through the state of Minnesota. That includes nurses, physicians, PTs, OTs, chaplains, lab techs, including funeral home directors, believe it or not. We have maintained our steadfast support for education, and the proposed deep cuts could threaten our ability to sustain this commitment. As a state, we face a massive challenge in balancing this budget, and we want to work with you to figure out this crisis. And we believe that everybody must deal in totality in the collective cuts of this pain. If the majority of these cuts are made in Health and Human Services, I am deeply concerned about the stability of our hospitals and our program and our staff. I thank you very much for the time. I thank you for so much, Senator Burgum, for holding this hearing today. I'm very honored to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do want to point one thing out that I think it's important that this witness said. I mean, Representative Abler has been focusing on the blunt instrument of these rate cuts to nursing homes and to hospitals. But I think the point that's been coming up from these testifiers is that it's really just cuts to Health and Human Services. And whether you make it in reducing eligibility or whether you make it in reducing hospitals as proposed here, it all comes out in the wash at the end, and these kind of cuts are unsustainable regardless of how we do it. And I think that's becoming clear as part of this discussion today. And the other thing I think is becoming clear and we need to keep our eye on is we always talk about this, and it was true on the House floor, and this I don't know about the Senate floor, I imagine, and it's true as we have these discussions, that we always distinguish between public and private health care, and that's not a real distinction. It's all healthcare dollars. I mean, actually, one of the things that if we did this proposal, this would actually be real cost containment. There's no question about that. And so it would be healthcare reform in a sense because we'd be bringing a lot of costs out of the system. I don't think it's necessarily the right way to do it. But I think we got to break out of some of the paradigms we've been thinking about this, and particularly this notion that that there's some kind of public health care system and set of dollars that the hospital systems and everybody else uses, and some kind of private health care set of dollars. They're all the same dollars. And at the end of the day, it's obvious. I hope that Governor Plenty is – maybe we should send him a tape of this session today, but that and the administration and others – that these are really, really devastating cuts, and there's no question if we do not get if we can't sustain at least some level of basic funding in these systems, we are all going to be losing in the end.
Representative Teasad, I think the point you make is very, very important. I've been trying to say this to my colleagues all throughout the session. If a hospital closes their mental health services, it isn't just public patients that lose those mental health services. It's the whole community that loses the mental health services. I would remind this conference committee we cut $200 million last session, which would translate into $400 million this year. And so when I say if we don't balance the budget this year, that we will cut $400 million, whether we do it this year all at one time or whether we do some of it this year and some of it next year and some of it the year after that, that is what will happen. We have to balance the budget. I'm absolutely and totally convinced of it, because if we don't, we will be balancing the budget here in this division over time.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then we're proposing $400 million cut, and you've got how much in the access fund, the health care access fund that's sitting there? So, again, I'd like to have a very honest discussion about how we're going to spend that.
Senator Rosen, the money that is sitting in the health care access fund is one-time money. I mean, if it were to be taken, it would not structurally balance the budget. Just be a little while longer before we take $400 million.
Madam Chair, our Minnesota Care direct appropriations from 08 were $303 million. And in FY13, they're projected to be double that, over double that, $626 million. Now,
Senator Rosen, that's
Minnesota Care. And then we still need to have that discussion about the most vulnerable. And you cannot cut long-term care facilities like that and leave the bottom line in healthcare access of about $240 million right now.
Senator Rosen, part of the reason that we've had an increase is because of the economy. We've had increased enrollment because people are losing their jobs, and at least some people still want to have health insurance that they pay something for. They aren't just showing up at the emergency room and saying, somebody else pay for me.
And Madam Chair, just to I think make the point you're making again, that $240 million that you're looking at in 2014, as my colleagues on the Republican side of the House make every time we go to the House floor, there's no money in the Health Care Access Fund. So that number you're looking at, it's being spent to cover people that are currently in our program right now.
And Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. Yes, and we keep adding people onto the rolls, and we keep expanding the benefit set. And I still think that we don't address that most vulnerable issue. And we're going to have a balance of $240 million that's sitting there, and we're going to be closing probably all of the nursing homes in my Senate district, and everybody else is on this side.
And
because they cannot sustain those cuts. So,
Senator Rosen, but you're wrong. There's not $240 million sitting there.
Right. I'd like to put this discussion on hold, and we will have the discussion. But I'd like to get Mr. Godfrey up here. I mean, he's trying to text me to talk to you. I'd like him to talk to you. We will have him up here because the numbers you're throwing around are not accurate.
Madam Chair, I've seen you text, too, so I know. That's going to take a long time.
Learned it late in life. So let's move on. Are there any more questions for Ms. Edwards? If not, then Bill Lindbergh.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Lindberg. I'm the senior director of the inpatient program at Courage Center, which is the home of the national champion Rolling Timberwolves wheelchair basketball team. I've worked at Courage Center approximately 3 years, and I feel like I'm kind of a minor player up here, but I feel that I'm a major player, that Courage Center actually is a major player for the disabled clients in all of Minnesota and even in areas surrounding Minnesota. We are an oasis that I like to look at as an oasis for the physically disabled. We provide services that meet the multitude of needs for patients who suffer many types of disabling conditions, especially traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injuries. Unfortunately, the people who have these kinds of injuries are not going away. We see them all the time coming into our facility, and they're not going away. The characteristics, we are classified as a nursing home. We're also classified as a Rule 80 facility for young disabled adults. But as such, with a skilled nursing facility, we like to look at ourselves as in the business of saving money for the clients that we serve and the payers that we serve. We meet all of nursing home requirements, but and we provide many of the services that acute care rehab settings provide, but we do it for about a third of the cost. And 100% of our clients are discharged to the community, to another setting, after their intense therapy that we have. My concern today is for, there have been cuts to the proposed cuts and past cuts by the House and Senate. But at the same time, we're looking at future cuts, potential for them. And the biggest concern that I have is that if cuts have to be made according to Governor Pawlenty's proposal in the therapy services that are provided to the clients that we serve, it would have a significant impact on our ability to stay open. Right now, we lose about $60 per day per client that come into the for our services at Courage Center. We make up that amount, and happily we do, with the therapy services we provide, which averages about 2 hours per day, and they're about 1 to 4 hours in a range with the clients that we serve. If there is any kind of a 25% cut, it would really endanger our ability to stay open. There was a flyer, I believe, that was handed out, or maybe not, I'm not sure, from Courage Center, that kind of shows some of the information, yes. The positive side of our services that we provide. And we are a niche in all of this, all of these programs that you're considering, but a very significant niche in that we provide a service that many nursing homes could not provide because of the extensive kinds of services that we must provide, plus all of the additional services that we provide to get clients to move back into the community and to live a very fruitful life, I might say, in the community. So we're very concerned about this. We worry about what would happen if there are further cuts into our programs, especially in what would happen to the clients if they have to stay in hospitals longer, especially if they have to go from a hospital into a nursing home for longer periods of time to try and receive their rehab services. And also, we are concerned that some of the programs that we provide would not be available to the clients that are being served. We have many, we are just a part of Curry Center, the inpatient program, but we have access to the many services for the clients that we serve. One of the issues we face with insurance companies, and I don't know if you have run into this issue or not, but insurance companies are paying for shorter and shorter stays for rehab clients. We in turn have to, because they're not ready to leave our facility into a place, they must have a source of payment. So the shorter stays that are paid for by the insurance companies, we have to try and get clients onto medical assistance sooner than we used to in the past. And that's an issue. I don't know if it becomes pertinent to your discussions at all, but insurance companies are paying shorter and shorter stays for the stays in our particular facility. In other nursing homes, that's not as big an issue, but it is becoming more of an issue. We have very little Medicare in our facility. So we have more clients who are paid for by insurances after they come out of the hospital for short periods of time. But many of the people then have to be, we try to get them on medical assistance then. Other tasks that we have been able to provide to clients that have been very successful for discharge are programs in pain management, programs in attending to wound care for clients that so they can discharge sooner, and also in adjustment to their newly found disability. Very, very traumatic times for clients. And so if any of the further cuts are being considered, they would really have a detrimental effect on us. And I think we'd probably end up losing a very fine program in the state of Minnesota. So anybody have any questions of me?
Any questions? I just have a comment, and that is that if anyone who is on this conference committee hasn't visited Courage Center, I would really encourage you to do so. And, in fact, if I get a chance in the next week, I might go out there myself because it is a place that is inspiring, and it is a place that makes you understand what the word courage means. And believe me, every once in a while around here, I think we could use a little more courage.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
May I make a comment, too? Congratulations on your national championship for the wheelchair.
In fact, we had two national championships.
Oh, it was great. The reason I'm commenting on that is because Senator Rosen and I have to leave for just a little bit during this hearing because we have the women's NCAA Division II champions from Minnesota State University Mankato, which is in our district, here waiting to meet and say hello with us. So we need to step out for a few minutes. So we enjoy the championships as much
as
you do.
I would challenge a group from this committee to come sit in wheelchairs and challenge our team. <Yep. laughs>
I'm sure they beat the pants off us. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karina Allen.
Madam Chair and the members of the committee, I ask you not to cut health care anymore. I guess that's not new. But most of us seniors developed our savings before salaries were so high. I have a cousin that I'm the health care conservator for. She will be 96 in October. I have a brother-in-law with Alzheimer's and many friends that are using these services. I think I know something about healthcare staffing from my days as a hospital employee, as well as a senior, 84 years old, with an 88-year-old husband. What kind of people are we that we are cutting some of these services that we have worked so hard to establish? It's right now the nursing homes are scraping the bottom of the barrel for help. And their job has a lot of stress. It's hard work when you try to help people at their worst, in their worst condition because of their physical and mental problems. In my second career as a social worker, I was surprised by how many had had money, but through medical problems, they were now on, because of medical problems, they were now on MA. Forgive me, I'm not as well coordinated here because I had to do this in a hurry. I want to state something that my friend Christine Stone said at the rally. Lawmakers prove to us, the voters, that Minnesota is still a state that takes care of those in the dusk of life. I am here on behalf of all of our loved ones who are growing older and need adequate funding for adequate care. It's not just nursing home funding that we are talking about. It's funding for services that allow elders to remain in their own homes and get the right amount of care. It's the cost-effective way. I think we've proven that for years now. And get the right amount of care. It's what most of us want to be able to do, to stay at home as long as we can. It is difficult to know what will happen next. My message today is simply to deliver to you a message that makes it clear that seniors and disabled people need good, solid, quality services. And I understand that many of you want to get rid of equalization. Well, I was working back in the days when we didn't have equalization. And all the nursing homes wanted private pay people, and they would spend more time. We had patients that we had to keep for so long because we couldn't find a nursing home bed for them. Everybody wanted the private pay. Now, that's not saving money to keep people in hospitals. Those beds are expensive beds. And it also had a two-tiered system. That's a lousy way to deliver health care. People have to be had to be moved to special homes or to special sections of nursing homes. That if that nursing home had a private pay section, it usually had a part that was just set aside for medical assistance. And it's hard on the patients that have been private paid and then are moved to that. We usually, if we're in the hospital, we usually didn't tell them that they were going to a nursing home. Because if you did, you had emotional problems. They would scream, cry, or say that they refused to go. And I didn't blame them. I didn't spend 30 years over here trying to help. And Senator Berglund, you and I have worked closely together getting some of these programs up, and it wasn't easy. Okay, that's equalization. That's going to cost you more in the end, I can promise you. I saw it. About the hospitals, my husband had a heart attack about 5 years ago. I called 911, and the paramedics were there in a very short time. I helped them put the leads, the paramedic who was putting the leads on for to read the cardiogram. and he was being monitored the whole time he was in the ambulance. When we reached Regents Hospital, because we live in St. Paul, there were two cardiologists at the door, and he went immediately to the cath lab because they had already been able to see where they were going to have to go in. He had a stent put in. He has only a 5% damage to his heart because everything was so fast. It was so efficient. He's in great shape for an 88-year-old. He cuts grass, even for some of the neighbors, vacuums for me sometimes, and can even screw the caps off of jars that I can't. Then Hennepin County Medical Center. When I worked there, that hyperbaric chamber was used a great deal when we had infections that were quite bad, the gangrene type thing. And it saved a lot of them. And it was the only hospital around for quite a way. I guess you have to go out to Seattle and the coast where they have the diving problems. But that saved a lot of those with gangrene. Pay cuts. Nurses have a pretty good scientific background, and I'm seeing a lot of them go to other things. It's not just, I mean, the pay, but it's also the fact that you're run so ragged that when you come home, you're just all wore out. So you're not getting as many coming into the field. And I know when my son applied for medical school, there were 11 applying for every opening. Today, or 2 or 3 years ago, I heard there were only 3 applying for every opening. Perhaps Representative Huntley knows more about that, but I understand they're not as eager to go into the field as they have been, which is a shame. Thank you very much for listening to me, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer
them. Thank you, Karina. Are there questions? Thank you again. Dr. Don Jacobs?
Thank you, Senator Berglund. 3 hours ago, I didn't know I was going to be here, and when I got here, I was prepared to talk to you about physicians. I know you don't want to hear about physicians today in particular, so I had to wing it a little bit, and I'm not going to talk about physicians because I know that's not exactly what's on your plate today. My name is Don Jacobs. I'm chairman and CEO of Hennepin Faculty Associates. I'm on the board of directors for Hennepin Health System, so many of the things I've heard today are very dear to my heart. But I'm here as a trustee of the Minnesota Medical Association, and I thought it was still appropriate to comment today since you have offered the opportunity on what's before you. We have worked with you and with many stakeholders in Minnesota in recent years on health reform. We've done a lot. We've come a long way. We are headed in a much better direction than we've been in the past to solve the problems ahead. And I think one of the places we have to remember is that we're starting in Minnesota with a healthcare system that is already better than most in the world, in this country. We have more cost-effective healthcare than most areas of this country. And one of the things that you have to recognize about it is the way we got there is we're pretty collaborative about how we provide care. We tend to group as systems and larger groups, whereas the average healthcare practice in the country is still only about 5 physicians. So that when we talk about hospitals, which you are talking about today, the hospitals are the economic engine that makes this work for healthcare right now. We can't afford to necessarily always have that be so, but that is how it works right now, and that is how bad things can happen when very good organizations, great organizations like Park Nicollet, all of a sudden are laying off individuals and closing clinics. The current economics don't work. But what I really wanted to say today and remind you and thank you for all the work that you've done to support healthcare and to support Minnesotans through this is that we at the MMA we're very concerned about our patients, which we consider really all of us in Minnesota. We're either patients now or we will be at some point, and in particular the vulnerable patients we serve. And I think the vulnerable in our communities didn't create the current financial crisis and certainly didn't create the broken healthcare system that we've been struggling for the past 15 years to correct. We believe they shouldn't be disproportionately targeted as we all work together to solve these difficult issues. Minnesota physicians are willing to bear a reasonable share of the pain that will be required to bring Minnesota through this economic and budgetary crisis. We do not, however, want to see Minnesota's high-quality healthcare system decimated in the process. We feel we must find a way, a balanced, fair way to bear the cost in the short term to support the most vulnerable through this crisis. And access to necessary health care is foundational to that safety net function. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share that today.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks again for the past help that you've been to us in working on health care reform. I'd like to call on Ann Baumstadt-Miller next.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Baumstadt-Miller. I'm here on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, which is a coalition made up of those who are advocates for consumers of long-term care as well as the long-term care workforce. Our mission is to improve the quality of care in long-term care for those who depend on it as well as those who provide it. And on behalf of the coalition, I'd just like to make a few comments. First, cutting rates in long-term care for the elderly translates into reduced staffing, impaired quality, and the effects and affects safety for the client and the worker. Approximately three-quarters of spending in long-term care goes to the workforce, to our caregivers. Long-term care workers are already low-wage workers, and some have to rely on public and private help in order to put food on the table. Layoffs of long-term care workers jeopardize the economies of Minnesota communities. The Conference Committee report just adopted was full of bitter pills, but we viewed it as a best-case scenario. Nursing homes saw a little bit of hope in the future in rebasing, and home and community-based services, such as adult day services, had a little reprieve in the 2.58% cut rather than 3% cut. You've already heard from my colleagues of the turmoil that would occur if these homes were to face a 25% cut. Workers would either face losing a job, and for those who remained, they'd be in a workforce of part-time, short-term, and poorly supported workers who were forced by circumstances to work at breakneck speed with highly dependent people, a recipe for tragedy. We know there are eligibility reductions coming in 2011, and we ask that you please preserve the trained staff and services we need to serve those with the highest needs in the future.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Thanks again. Mark McAvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark McAfee with AFSCME Council 5. When I got the email about this hearing at 10:30 p.m. last night, I sent the word out to some of our workers, but they couldn't get off today. So I'll make a few comments.
This won't be the last chance.
Okay. Certainly. But I, the reason I made that comment is I have with me a couple of folks who are resident in one of the facilities we represent and also her father. But first I'll comment, as you know from prior hearings, that we represent folks, first of all, the hospitals. You've heard from the major hospitals where we have folks, Regions, HCMC, Fairview University. I know HCMC, just off the end allotments, had 100 positions affected. and no doubt there'd be much, there'd be very major impacts. I also am concerned about a lot of rural communities where they have some of these small hospitals, some of which have been tied into larger systems now, and they are in effect really just sort of a triage center, almost an urgent care center. If we take those out, people will die as a result of these cuts. Nursing facilities, we represent folks. You've heard from Walker, one of our major ones, and you know Senator Berglund's very close to your, right near your district there. Judging by John Hewn's formula, it looks like we'd have 100 layoffs at Walker. It would really devastate care there if that happened. We represent folks at a number of other nursing homes. I think when it comes down to it, a lot of you heard the wages. Wearing another hat, I chair the Jobs Now Council. I can tell you, if people are making $10, $11 an hour, you cannot make it without being on some type of public assistance. And so, you know, these cuts could hit jobs. You could have closure facilities, disruption for the residents and their families. You'll probably end up with some foreclosures. And I think eventually it would hit the schools. E-12 education, it should be said here today, is not an island unto itself, and neither is the Health and Human Services. We're in this together in the community, and I think we have to wake up for that. We represent folks at ICFMRs, including the Lake Owosso residents, and with that, I'd like to just briefly turn it over with your indulgence to Al Wolfram and his daughter, Tara.
Thank you. My name is Al Wolfram. I'm a state coordinator for VOR, a national advocacy group for special needs individuals. And this is my daughter, Tara Marie. She lives at Lake Owosso. First thing I want to do is to thank those of you who have been struggling and fighting to keep the cuts from happening. I want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Believe me, this doesn't always come out, how grateful we are, and I want you to know that we are that grateful. Secondly, those of you who are saying, gee, you know, I'm sorry, we got to make the cuts. We can't have any increase in taxes. I respect people very much who have values and stick to them. I really do, because I have values and I stick to my values. But you know something? There comes a time when you have to bend or you have to break. And this is a time when you have to bend. A short time ago, there were cuts. And because of those cuts, the aide was taken off from the van, which took my daughter's friend to work and her roommate to work. While they were driving to work, she got into her lunch. Before the driver could get pulled off to the side, she took too large of a bite, and she choked to death because of those cuts. Ladies and gentlemen, when they talk about lives being put in jeopardy, we're not making idle chatter here. 80% of the cost of running an ICFMR, such as 75 to 80%, such as Lake Owosso, is staffing. That's who's going to be cut. Same thing at nursing homes, same thing with hospitals. That means people's lives are going to be put in jeopardy. Are you willing to do that? Now, earlier, the people from Gillette Hospital talked about miracles. Take a look at this young lady. Several years ago, I gave up a budding acting career, moved back to St. Paul. One reason, because this young lady was having 200 to 300 seizures a day. And I was told the only place in the United States that I could get help, there were two possibilities. One, I could go to a commune in France, or two, I could come to Gillette Children's Hospital. We came back, and Gillette Children's Hospital started her on a road to a miracle. She's been seizure-free now for the last 6 years. So with that, the only other thing I want to do is I want to put a face on this for you. I want to pass around her photo. Please, each one of you, keep a photo. Look at that photo when you have to make a decision. Keep it on your end and keep a person in mind. And I think Tara would like to say one thing.
Welcome, Tara.
Please, I had something. Once they say now, there's something in for things And right now at Wausau, we like to thank you guys for thinking. Please save the money. You know, we don't want to take away a credit foundation, and we don't want to. We want to keep the accreditation for others around us. In what we Alfie just said right now, and we want to keep it in the bank for my vacation right now with my father right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you all. Catherine Commit or Julie Bruner?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment about the possibility of making deeper cuts to the Health and Human Services budget. We agree that the growth of the HHS budget is creating an incredible strain on the state, and we also agree that we must slow the rate of increases or we'll crowd out every other budget need. But we have to be very careful about how we go about slowing the growth of Health and Human Services. Making further draconian cuts to providers and cutting people off of programs is not the way to solve the problem. There's no doubt these cuts will hurt real people. Deeper budget cuts will translate into people delaying treatment, resulting in more expensive care in the emergency room and hospital. The increased costs of uncompensated care will be shifted to those with commercial health coverage. And as a result, the cost of health coverage will increase, pricing even more people out of the commercial market. I also want to add that if these cuts were to go into effect, we believe it will affect access to care, further exacerbating the situation. Providers and perhaps hospitals could close, making it even harder for people to get care. Last year's health care reform begins to move us in the right direction, but we need to do more. We believe we need to completely change our reimbursement system to pay for value, not volume. There is no doubt if the legislature is forced to cut even deeper, there will be real consequences for real people, for the patients, and for employers who provide coverage for their workers. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Ronald Brand. I think maybe he's not here. Ethan Roberts.
Senator Bourbon, I'm here.
Okay.
Just in the corner there.
Good afternoon, Senator Burgley, members of the committee. My name is Ethan Roberts. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. But I'm here today because I, in my capacity as Director of Government Affairs, represent Shalom Community Alliance, which is a consortium of provides senior services, including two nursing homes, one in St. Louis Park and one in St. Paul. And altogether, it's about 270 beds. And so I understand that you wanted to hear testimony regarding proposed cuts to the nursing homes. And to be honest, I was not prepared to testify regarding a 25% cut. I could extrapolate. We understand that would be about $2.75 million loss, about 11% of our overall operating budget, and about six times worse than the cuts which I was prepared to testify to, which was back during before the conference report was finalized. The Senate had a potential cut to certain nursing homes, which are in kind of the more expensive nursing homes, and we qualified for that. And so we were looking at a cut of about $380,000. And so what I could tell you about that is that would have been about 10 positions, and mainly in the care area of direct services. We have been making cuts over the years. We have been trying to get leaner, and there isn't much admin left to cut. And so there's really no way to do it without affecting quality of care. And, there's a saying around the Capitol, and I've been here long enough, Everything that needs to be said has already been said, but not everyone has said it. And so, cognizant of that, I don't want to go on for too long. But I do want to pose this question, though. And I asked Representative Abler this before he was before he left. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about if we increase taxes, that's a job killer, right? That's going to kill jobs. People are going to leave the state, or people are going to stop employing people, and you know, I haven't heard enough evidence to think that's necessarily true, in comparison at least to the jobs that we know will be killed if these cuts go through. And I honestly don't really think that we're going to see a 25% cut to nursing homes. And I think that that's not likely to happen. But there will be a cut if there's no new revenue. There's no question about that. Maybe it's 3%, maybe it's 4%, depending on your home. And I absolutely believe that those job losses will be greater than the losses we will see if revenue, as proposed last Friday night, is part of the solution. And so if you were simply to look at it from a utilitarian perspective of jobs and forget all of the incredible work that the hospitals and the nursing homes provide for people, and just leave that aside, leave the societal good of that, leave aside the social contract that we've entered into with our seniors and our disabled, if you were just to completely forget all that and just look at it, jobs to jobs, where is the evidence that by raising revenues as proposed last week, that would hurt more jobs than are going to be lost if there aren't revenues? And so that's the question I think you all have to consider, okay, if that's what's really most important to you is number of jobs. And, you know, when we are an employer and, you know, we have private clients and we have government-funded clients and we fundraise, we're good at fundraising, but we can't make it up all on that. Okay, it's too expensive. So that's what I would like to leave you with, is that if you just simply care about maximizing the number of jobs in the Minnesota economy, because there's only one Minnesota economy, it's not a private economy over there and a public economy over there, it's one economy, then what are you doing? You know, what are the repercussions going to be? And there's been plenty of evidence, I believe, today about what those are going to look like in terms of job losses. And I haven't heard much in terms of real evidence about if we raise revenues, what that's going to look like. Maybe we'll hear that, but I'm not buying it. Thank you so much, Senator Berglund. Thank you so much, Representative Huntley and members of the committee. I know you guys have been working around the clock, and you have my greatest admiration and respect for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Jim Meffert Nelson? Okay. Then I think we've completed our agenda today. Oh, I think I forgot somebody.
Yes. Madam Chair, if I may, Bruce Nelson from ARM. Your blood sugar is probably like mine, so I'll be very, very brief. Otherwise, we might have to go across the street to the hospital. From ARM, we represent providers supporting people with disabilities and ICFSMR and the various wayward services and employ about 27,000 people. I'd be very quick and very blunt. The proposal on the table would close, I think it's fair to say, every ICFMR in the state. In fact, I'm aware of at least two under a 3% scenario that would close their doors. So essentially, with 2,000 people living in ICFMR, you are evicting 2,000 people under this. You're not, Senator Berglund, I know that. But under this proposal, essentially 2,000 people would be evicted from their homes, and they are their homes. Where would they go? Well, they could possibly go into waivered services, but typically ICFMR enjoy some economies of scale, so you're placing people into, on a per-person basis, arguably more expensive settings or institutions where the same would apply. So it's very cruel to people, that proposal would be, and it would be very ineffective in a cost sense. Now, in the DTH world, that doesn't presumably affect waivered programs or ICFMR, but essentially we heard today that kind of a cut would close the ICFMR of about DTHs with about 13,000 people. Where do they go during the day? But right now they go to jobs, they go to day activities to the DTHs. If they didn't have DTHs, they'd have to come back home. And home is the group home, the waiver, you know, the DD waiver or what have you. And with that cut that would be made, and the elimination of the program, essentially the funding that supports from the DTNH world would not be transferable anymore, so you'd basically be sending people to a waiver program or to an ICF with an unfunded mandate to provide services to people during the day when typically the staff isn't there, and you are then going down the road again to closure of those facilities. Again, a very cruel, and I know it's not your intent to do it, thing for people, and very ineffective in a cost sense. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you.
Are there questions? Sir. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Nelson, I probably should know this, but actually I don't. These people are eligible for medical assistance, by and large. And what is the federal requirement for what we have to do for these people if they are eligible for medical assistance?
Well, presumably the eligibility for the ICF from our world is typically an IQ of around 70. I don't know if that's been updated or not. That's the basis for eligibility then for the waiver program. In the waiver, however, while ICF Samar have a pretty long list of requirements that are federally mandated in the waiver, we could, if we wanted to waive what are now state regulations, have much more flexibility than we now do have. So the requirements in the waiver programs are much less rigorous from a federal mandate point of view, but they're increasingly more rigorous from a state perspective as we've begin to layer upon regulations here in Minnesota. Hence, a bill that we had this year, Representative Thiessen carried, Senator Lurie carried, that would, let's take another look at all this and see where there's duplication and come up with a set of standards that really are more cost-effective and more genuinely reflect is what the waiver really should be looking at, and I think the intent was the quality of a person's life. And not just going through the mandates of do you know how to brush your teeth and those kinds of things. So let's go back, and that's where we're going with this, go back to the outcomes in a person's life that meet his or her needs in a quality sense rather than a regulatory sense. So well, hopefully we're moving in that direction, and I appreciate your support of that measure.
Other questions? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Nelson, what I'm trying to get at is, are we required by federal law to take care of these people?
Yes, but there is a waiting list. So within the strictures of, you know, the money we have. To be honest, Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I don't know exactly where the wiggle room is and are not meeting people on the waiting list. Maybe somebody else does.
Madam Chair, maybe tomorrow we could have somebody from Human Service educate me on what we are required to do with this population by the federal law.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify today? There will be more opportunities for people to testify tomorrow. If not, then Representative Huntley, what time would you like to convene the meeting tomorrow?
Madam Chair, I think 10 would work.
All right, we'll be adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow.